Recording started.
Okay, it's our pleasure with assorted technical issues and challenges to present our colleague, Dr. Veena Tirvengadam from the Center for Language and Literature, who will be talking today about the Three Musketeers, All for One, One for All, where the real musketeer, Alexandre Dumas, please stand up. Dr. Veena Tirvengadam has been assistant professor of French in the Center for Language and Literature since 2003. She has a doctorate in French literature and specializes in the 20th century French novel and is also interested in 19th century French literature and French literature of the Middle Ages and 17th and 18th centuries, as well as the writings of Francophone writers outside of France. Before coming to Athabasca University, Dr. Tirvengadam taught French, mainly literature courses, at the two main universities in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and also taught many advanced translation courses in French. I am not Francophone, so you notice I'm skipping a lot of the French words. That's to avoid offending the ears of my colleagues sitting down the table. Although her first language is French, she's quite comfortable with the English language and often publishes articles on French literature in both French and English. Her main area of research is in the field of authorship attribution to pseudonymous, am I saying that right, works and works of disputed authorship. Applying standard authorship attribution models, she evaluates the reliability of the concept that style is dictated by the subconscious and forms the quote-unquote genetic fingerprint of the writer's work. She has demonstrated that well-known French writer Romain Gary assumed a different persona and used a different linguistic fingerprint when he wrote the novel La Vie d'Avant Soi under the pseudonym of Émile Ajar, for which he received a second Prix Goncourt. She also is now doing preliminary research on the writings of Alexandre Dumas-Pierre with a view to establishing whether the real author behind the novels for which he is best known, and I'm going to say them in English, The Three Musketeers, The Count of Monte Cristo, and Queen Margot could have been written wholly or partly by a ghostwriter, namely Auguste-Jules Maquet, or Maquet, I suppose. She's just had a 3,500-word article on Dumas published in the prestigious Literary Encyclopedia in the UK, and she's also adding finishing touches on an article on Romain Gary, which she will submit to the Literary Encyclopedia shortly. Okay, without further ado, I turn you over to our colleague, Dr. Veena Tirvengadam.
Yes, well, hello everybody. Welcome to my talk, for those of you who are here and for those of you who are in Calgary, as well as at AU Central. Hello, Alice. Can you hear me? Can you hear me, all of you? Yeah. Okay, so before starting my talk, I'm just going to ask a general question. I'm going to ask you, has anyone ever heard of an author called Stendhal? Anyone? Yes, yes. Have you heard of Zola? Yes. Have you heard Le Rouge et Le Noir, The Red and the Black? Yes, yes. Have you? Have you ever heard of The Three Musketeers? Is there anyone here who has not heard of The Three Musketeers? No, I think you've all heard of The Three Musketeers. Why is that? It's because it was written by one of the most prolific French writers in French literature. And his name was Alexandre Dumas. So I'm going to read because there's so much that I have to tell you, and if I don't read, I'm going to leave out lots of important information that you might find interesting. So the life of Alexandre Dumas has been told many, many times by biographers, by critics, and by himself in his memoirs. He is the author of many plays, of many novels, many travelogues as well. He was a contributor to well-known newspapers of his day, such as La Presse and Le Constitutionnel. All his writings brought him great success and popularity. They also earned him a very respectable salary, which allowed him to lead a very lavish lifestyle. his memoirs and his biographies all point to someone who led a very active life, personally, socially, and creatively. Dumas was a first-class dramatist and historical novelist, and he was among the first writers in France to use the possibilities of what is known as le roman feuilleton, the serialized novel. He is especially known for Le Comte de Monte Cristo, Les Trois Mousquetaires. Can you show the slide? Oh, I'm sorry, we should have shown you a slide of Dumas. I'm sorry, I forgot to show. This is him. That's a picture of him that I found online. And the next slide, please. So an iconic portrayal, if you wish, of the Three Musketeers. Also, La Reine Margot. No, I'll tell you why they're four in a minute. I'll tell you why. There are three of them plus another one. All three novels that are filled with sword fights, beautiful women, heroic men, cloak and dagger episodes, and narrow escapes, and where the subjects of treachery, revenge, and love appear in abundance. His stories have been translated in almost 100 languages, if not more, have inspired more than 200 motion pictures, plays, TV series, etc. While he was a first-class dramatist and a great historical novelist, he never attained the literary stature of the giants of his day, like Balzac, Victor Hugo, Stendhal, Flaubert, and Zola. But he is the most flamboyant, prolific, and the most widely read of all of them, while his exuberant imagination was equaled by no one except perhaps by Victor Hugo of Notre-Dame de Paris and Les Misérables fame, which I'm sure you've all heard of. Yeah? He was an extroverted, engaging, and amiable man of mixed ancestry. And like his character Porthos in English, he lived life to the fullest. He also had numerous love affairs, which produced four illegitimate children. As I have alluded to in my abstract, there is another dimension to his writings. No other French writer of the 19th century has depicted scenes of political intrigues, vengeance, perversion, graphic eroticism, sex, poisonings, torture, executions, and beheadings quite like him. And because of his prolific output, there were often attacks against his good name. But he chose to live his life in an exuberant, lavish, and loud manner. So in this talk, I shall give an account of the tumultuous life of Alexandre Dumas, père, and I'll tell you why later, from his birth to his death, because there are two Alexandre Dumas. One is père, senior, and one is fils, his son. So I'm talking about the father here. Alexandre Dumas was born on the 24th of July, 1802, in the small town of Villers-Cotterêts, situated near Paris. He was what is known in French as a carteron. I don't know if I can translate that in English. He was the son of a biracial father of French and African blood named Thomas Alexandre David de la Pailleterie. Can we have the next slide, please? And of a white mother. Alexandre Dumas' father, this fellow, was the illegitimate son of a French nobleman, the Marquis Alexandre David de la Pailleterie, who had gone to Saint-Domingue, present-day Haiti, to make his fortune. There he had fathered a few illegitimate children with his African slave girl named Marie-Louise Césette, nicknamed La Dumas. When Marie-Louise Césette Dumas died in a cholera outbreak, the Marquis returned to France in 1975, but not before selling his children into slavery to other white planters. I know, it's shocking, isn't it? But this was a normal practice in those days, for in the eyes of all the white planters, and also as sanctioned by the Code Noir that had been established by Colbert under the reign of Louis XIV, still practiced in Haiti at that time, these children were slaves, and as such, they could be disposed of at will. But once in France, the Marquis did bring back one of his sons, namely Thomas Alexandre. And according to Dumas' account in his memoirs, the Marquis brought him up as a young aristocrat, made him learn the art of fencing and sword fighting. But in 1786, the son quarreled with his father when the father, at the advanced age of 78, I think, married his housekeeper. Leaving his father's house, the son enlisted in the army as a private soldier under his mother's name, Dumas, which he would keep when he became a famous novelist. As a private soldier, and also because of his biracial heritage, he probably would not have gone very far in the army. But with the advent of the French Revolution, however, when all citizens were considered somewhat equal, perhaps some more equal than others, I don't know, he rapidly rode through the ranks. He met another famous biracial aristocrat, the Chevalier de Saint-Georges. Do you know who he is? Who rose to the top of French society through his mastery of fencing and his genius for classical music. In fact, he's referred to as the Black Mozart. Have you heard of him? Together they served in la Légion Franche des Américains, and because of his phenomenal strength and also because of his great courage, Thomas Alexandre Dumas soon became general at the age of 31. And he became also one of Napoleon's favorite generals and participated with him in many of his campaigns, such as the Italian and Egyptian campaigns. But all this was to change, however, when in 1801, Toussaint Louverture, a black slave in Haiti, led a struggle for independence from the French. Napoleon Bonaparte promptly sent a force of 200,000 trained soldiers to crush the insurrection. He also asked Thomas Alexandre to participate in this campaign. But Thomas Alexandre refused by reminding Napoleon that he was the son of a black slave woman, that as such he could not bring chains and dishonor to his race, to her race. So this act would earn him the implacable enmity of Napoleon. Thomas Alexandre left Egypt, sailed to France, but was shipwrecked off the Italian port of Taranto, I think, where he was made a prisoner of war by the King of Naples. And Napoleon never made any attempt to pay a ransom for his freedom. Therefore, he lingered in prison for 2 years, where there were constant attempts to poison him with arsenic. When he was finally released, he went to live with his family in Villers-Cotterêts. By that time, he was partially paralyzed, almost blind in one eye, and deaf in one ear. On the 20th of May, 1802, Napoleon Bonaparte reinstated slavery, which had been abolished by the French Revolution. He also dismissed all black and mulatto officers from the army. And although Thomas Alexandre had fought so valiantly by the side of Napoleon's army, he was never restored to active duty with Napoleon. And the military pension which was owed to him remained unpaid. In November 1792, Thomas Alexandre had married the French woman Marie-Louise Elisabeth Labouret. Next slide, please. So they had two daughters and one third child, a son, whom they named Alexandre, our author. General Thomas Alexandre died in 1806 when young Alexandre was only 4 years old. His mother received a modest living allowance left by her dead husband's title of nobility, but received no help from Napoleon. She moved in with her parents at their hotel and could only afford to give her son a very basic and incomplete education. But she told him stories about his father's heroic life exploits, his wartime triumphs, the hardship the general had endured, his wild adventures, which Dumas would later fictionalize in his famous novels, his most famous novels. In fact, the memory of the swashbuckling father would forever haunt the imagination of the son. By all accounts, young Alexander was a handsome child. However, the death of the father had meant slow poverty for his family, which would darken his childhood and his adolescence. And Alexandre did not take very easily to his studies. He was inattentive to the Latin lessons being dispensed by l'abbé Grégoire. He hated the violin lessons that his mother forced him to take. As soon as he was able to work, he found employment as a solicitor's clerk at Villers-Cotterêts and started working for a lawyer friend of the family. He also discovered two great attractions of his life, his passion for women, which started with a steamy affair in the arms of a young local girl named Algae Pillier, and his love for literature through his association with a young man from Paris, Adolphe. Adolphe was an aspiring playwright who was just starting to write what are known as pièces de boulevard, which are the equivalent of vaudeville plays. He chose Alexandre as his collaborator and inculcated the rudiments of dramatic art for young Alexandre. He also filled Alexandre Dumas' head with wonderful stories about Paris. In 1823, Dumas left for Paris in order to seek help from his father's old compagnon d'armes. One of them was so impressed by his beautiful handwriting that he helped him gain employment as a copyist in the offices of the Duke d'Orléans, who would later become King Louis-Philippe when the 1830 revolution would oust King Charles the Tenth. Young Alexandre received a meager salary of 1,200 francs, had to work long hours for a difficult and demanding patron, but he nevertheless found time to go to the theater, and he also met a woman by the name of Marie-Laure Catherine Labbé. The next slide, please. Yeah. A dressmaker who was 8 years older than him and who soon became his lover. They had an illegitimate son together, the very son who would later become the famous author and playwright Alexandre Dumas fils, Alexandre Dumas Jr. I have a slide to show him. So that's the son of the author I'm talking about. And this fellow is also the author of La Dame aux Camélias, The Lady with the Camélias, translated in English as Camille, and later Verdi would turn this into the opera La Traviata. And he would be admitted in the Académie Française in 1874. The son would be admitted, not the father. So as Dumas, the father's education had been incomplete, he decided to embark on the task of educating himself. He devoured books with the same vigor, enthusiasm, and appetite with which he would enjoy life. It was also at this time that he gained entrance into the most prestigious literary circles of his days. And he met someone called Charles Nodier, an influential figure in the French Romantic movement. He also met there the famous playwrights Victor Hugo, Alfred de Vigny, etc. These are all French playwrights. He charmed his way into various salons, which were exploring the new romantic ideas of German writers like Schiller and Goethe, and English writers like Walter Scott and Byron. He won the approval of many ladies of these houses and often started love affairs with many of them. One of them being Mélanie Valdor, can you show the next slide, who had a famous father, a former newspaper editor, who had a huge library and collection of literary memorabilia. At the time, this woman, Mélanie Valdor, was married to an army captain, but he was usually absent in pursuit of his military career, and the two carried on this very passionate affair. In 1830, the July Revolution broke out in France. I don't know if some of you have seen Les Misérables on stage. Has anyone seen it? The barricades, all the students? Well, it was during that revolution, I think. So the revolution broke out. It would lead to the overthrow of the Bourbon monarch, King Charles X of France, and to the ascent of Louis-Philippe, the Duke d'Orléans, who had been the patron of Alexandre Dumas. I have a picture of Louis-Philippe, who became king. Alexandre Dumas, who disliked the former kings, the Bourbons, he disliked them because in his eyes they were stifling free thought. So he participated wholeheartedly in the skirmishes which followed during the July Revolution. He even shot at the king's soldiers. He captured important powder magazines, which he handed over to the revolutionaries in Paris, who desperately needed ammunition. He also traveled to various parts of France in order to help defend the country against other insurrections. All the while, Dumas was writing plays and attempting to have them performed on the Parisian stage. However, the euphoria brought about by the July Revolution soon dissipated when La Comédie Française, I have a slide of La Comédie Française here, it's one of the most prestigious theaters in France, in Paris. The most prestigious theater in Paris, which was founded under the reign of Louis XIV, entrenched in old traditions, refused to stage his plays, as well as those of Victor Hugo and Vigny, because they were melodramas and not classical plays, neoclassical plays. So these plays, these new romantic plays, were new, and they offered a different vision of drama. And Dumas, like Hugo, had no choice than to fall back on the less prestigious Théâtre de Boulevard, so the vaudeville theaters. In 1831, another child was born to him, this time with another lover, who went by the name of Belle Crèzamère. By the mid-1830s, Dumas, conscious of the inadequacy of his formal education, read all he could on the history of France. He also took courses in physics, chemistry, in anatomy, physiology, etc., also about the administration of poison. He would later put this knowledge to good use in the writing of his historical novels. His literary career started in 1829 with a successful presentation of a drama called Henri III et sa cour, Henry III and his court. I have a slide here. It is a five-act play, the first of the great romantic historical dramas shown on the Paris stage, and it even preceded Victor Hugo's very famous play called Hernani. The play is considered as a landmark in the history of the French theater. It also contains the seed of many themes that Dumas would later explore in his novels. It depicted the secret love affair between two historical characters, Saint-Mégrin and La Duchesse de Guise. It is set in the 16th century, in France, in the time of another French king, Henri III, Henry III. I have a slide of this king, yeah. The last of the Valois monarchs, and he describes him as effeminate, weak, corrupt, and treacherous, a king who surrounds himself with what Dumas describes as les mignons, who are perfumed young men who flatter the king and do his bidding, while the king maneuvers to maintain his grip on the throne against powerful and unscrupulous rivals. Henry's elderly mother, Catherine de Médicis, who had been an Italian princess, helps introduce the political techniques of the Borgia in the play, namely poison, assassination, and betrayal into French politics. As the play opens then, Henry's rule is threatened by his cousin, the Duc de Guise, who wants to unseat Henry. In the course of the play, the Duc de Guise succeeds in ridding himself of his rival, Saint-Mégrin, his wife's lover, by having him strangled. The play was very successful. It starred famous actors of the day and would be played about 153 times. And many of the characters in the play, including Henry, Catherine de Médicis, etc., would reappear later in the trilogy of La Reine Margot. Even the Duke d'Orléans, who had been neither friendly nor kind towards Dumas, was the first one to applaud his talent as a playwright. The Duke even made him his assistant librarian, increased his annual salary. By the mid-1830s, however, Dumas became increasingly conscious of the inadequacy of his education, and now he started to read history books very seriously. And his plan was to create the French historical novel, which would be as respected as the novels of Sir Walter Scott. He also decided to give up his job as an administrator and to focus on his writing career, and then he wrote plays, many plays. So the very successful play, Henri III et sa cour, was followed by another equally successful one. This one was named Antony, a play of erotic intrigue and marital infidelity, which idealized romantic love, attacked conventional ideas of marriage, and also contained many historical anecdotes. The main character, Antony, was based on Dumas himself, and that of the female character, Adèle, was based on Mélanie Valdor, his lover, the married woman with whom he was having an affair. The parts of Antony and Adèle were admirably portrayed by the handsome boulevard French actor, Bocage, who excelled in melodrama, and the famous actress Marie Dorval. They were very well known in the 19th century. And the story goes thus. I have to tell you the story because it's quite interesting. The hero Antony, who has always loved Adèle, could not marry her because he is illegitimate, whereas she is a member of the aristocracy. But he meets her again by chance after a 3-year separation. Although she is now married to someone of her own class, is the mother of 3 children, she succumbs to his advances. And their love affair creates a scandal around them and threatens her reputation. When he implores her to run away with him, Adèle cannot bring herself to do so. Driven by love and despair, she implores Antony to kill her, which he does, out of love for her. He takes all responsibility upon himself by claiming that he killed her in an act of jealousy because she had spurned his love. That's the next slide. So, by this act, I'm sorry, it's a bit flu. By this act, he has cleared her of all blame. After the first performance of the play, women spectators sobbed openly. They moaned pitifully, ripped apart their lace handkerchiefs, all hoping to be able to inspire such love and adoration in a man. Male spectators also applauded this impossible and dramatic love story of the young, melancholic hero, whom they all wished to emulate. Every woman fell in love with Antony, and every man with Adèle. The play was so popular that it was performed more than 100 times. So Dumas had arrived. Classical critics denounced the play, but the young romantics hailed Dumas as their leader. There was even talk of opening the play in the prestigious Comédie Française, but this was quashed when an article in Le Constitutionnel denounced the play as being immoral because it was about infidelity, etc. The next successful play was, this one is even more interesting, if we can have the next slide. Yeah, it's called La Tour de Nesle, a play set in medieval France. Now this one contains scenes of sex, betrayal, was considered at the time the greatest masterpiece of French melodrama. It is based on a 15th century legend about a queen of France, probably 14th century Jeanne de Bourgogne, a daughter-in-law of Philip IV of France, known as Philippe le Bel, Philip the Handsome, who together, Jeanne de Bourgogne, with her 2 sisters-in-law, all daughters-in-law to the king, had led a life of debauchery in La Tour de Nesle, in this tour. These 3 women would entice unsuspecting young lovers at night to their bedchambers, which were situated on the top floor of the tower. There they would engage in orgies for hours. In the early morning hours, however, these 3 princesses would have their unlucky lovers murdered, have their bodies sewn into sacks, and thrown in the river Seine. One of these lovers, a philosophy professor from La Sorbonne by the name of Buridan, escaped death by jumping out of the window of the tower before he could be murdered, and he was rescued by his students, who had placed a boat filled with hay under the windows of the tower. Buridan's indiscretions furnished the plot of the play. Here is a poster of the play which was being shown in 1889, the next one. You can't really see it, but there's a picture on the right of these women, these naughty women, trying to entice the young men to their chambers. Of course, they would murder them afterwards. Well, it was shocking to present this on the stage, especially when the French had been so used to classical theater. But they were well received. Between 1831 and 1843, Dumas wrote many other plays. Next slide. Which were performed, I can't tell you the plot of each one because that would take forever, which were performed in various Parisian boulevard theaters. All these plays were immensely popular, and again, they all helped inaugurate the new romantic dramas. They also helped change theater from the neoclassical style, which had dominated the Parisian theater, and also served as a reaction against the ultra-conservative political, moral, and cultural climate of the Restoration. I have to go back to the year 1832, when Paris was stricken with the cholera epidemic. There are numerous accounts of the frenzy and sudden deaths which followed it. Theaters closed their doors so as to prevent the contamination to spread. Scared, Dumas left Paris for another town called Nogent-le-Rotrou, but cholera had arrived there too. So he went back to his apartment at Rue Saint-Lazare in Paris, where he continued to write plays and to receive friends. One evening, as Franz Liszt, I think you all know who he is, and another friend called Louis Boulanger, who had dropped by to see him, were taking their leave, he was overcome with chills and a high fever, which signaled the symptoms of cholera. It left him ill for weeks, but under his doctor's orders, he left Paris, and during a three-month period, he traveled across Europe and North Africa in order to convalesce. He kept an account of all his travels and adventures and started writing his travel impressions, which constituted some of the most attractive parts of his work and contributed to his popularity. These accounts of his travels, where the main character is always himself, are interspersed with the narratives, accounts, stories, and legends of countries he visited, and they prepared him for his greatest feat of all, namely a writer of historical fiction. On the 1st of February 1840, he married the actress Ida Ferrier, I think. Next slide. This is his wife. His official wife, he did marry one, but he never had any children with her, continued with a multitude of love affairs with other women. That same year, Dumas met, He met a very important man by the name of Auguste Macquet, a struggling writer. This was the beginning of one of the greatest collaborations in French literary history. Macquet was born in Paris in 1813, trained as a historian, but he turned to literature and became close with illustrious literary figures of his day. And according to most accounts, Dumas was given a play by Macquet. He rewrote it, producing a successful drama. After this, the two started writing historical romances together, with Macquet outlining the plot and characters in draft form, and Dumas adding colorful dialogues and details. For nearly 20 years, the two worked closely together. And again, according to most critics, those I've read, Macquet supplied historical facts and ideas, and Dumas would embellish and expand the stories and create some of the longest and most captivating inventions in French literature, namely Le Comte de Monte Cristo, Le Comte de Monte Cristo, Count of Monte Cristo, the trilogy of Les Trois Mousquetaires, The Three Musketeers, and many others that I do not have time to mention here. In fact, Macquet collaborated with Dumas on 18 novels and many plays. The next slide will give us a list of these novels and plays. At the insistence of the publisher, Macquet's name was left off the title page of these novels. Yeah. But in return, he received generous fees. And Macquet did die comfortably well off. And he's buried today in Père Lachaise, a cemetery in Paris. As for the plots of the novels, the three most famous I will tell you what they are, although I think most of you probably know, but I'll go over it anyway. Le Comte de Monte Cristo. Is there anyone who doesn't know the plot? Have you all read it? Okay, I'll go over it. It was first serialized, Le Comte de Monte Cristo was first serialized in the Journal des Débats from August 1844 to January 1846. It is a tale of revenge and retribution about the young Edmond Dantès, who on the day he is to be married to his true love, is wrongfully denounced as a Bonapartiste by the machinations of three enemies. Found guilty of treason, he is condemned to solitary confinement in the miserable Chateau d'If. Next slide, please. Oh. Don't have it. Okay. Let's go back a little bit. Yeah. Next one. Yeah. Maybe this one. So this Chateau d'If, it does exist. It is in the Mediterranean, off Marseille somewhere. And what would happen, I think, in the time of Louis XIV, it was turned into a prison where people would be sent for whatever, for offending the king or not bowing before the king when he walked by. So they'd be sent there. So anyway, this character, Edmond Dantès, is condemned to solitary confinement in this miserable chateau. There he befriends another prisoner, l'abbé Faria, heir to a great treasure, le trésor des Borgia, which is buried on the island of Monte Cristo. After the abbé's death, Dantès escapes from the Chateau d'If and finds the treasure. Years later, disguised as the wealthy Count of Monte Cristo, Edmond returns to his native land to search for justice. One by one, he wreaks revenge on all those who had wronged him. Although he is a kind of superhero with the power to punish his enemies, he is also the self-doubting hero of the romantic imagination. He is lonely. And the price of vengeance is bitter. It does not bring him the fulfillment for which he craved, but leaves him emotionally crippled. At the end, though, he finally finds love and he learns to forgive. And the tale of Edmond Dantès, which contained historical realism and psychological depths, whilst being a moral book, electrified readers. And the next one, there's another slide of Chateau d'If, and the next slide, please. Iconic representation of the Musketeers, and I think you asked me why there are four of them. I will tell you why in a minute. So Les Trois Mousquetaires was originally serialized and published in the journal Le Siècle from March to July 1844. With its numerous and sudden plot developments, it is the perfect example of the typical action-packed swashbuckler. It recounts the adventures of the central character, D'Artagnan, a young, impoverished nobleman from Gascony, who leaves home to become a guard of the musketeers in 17th century France. He meets three brave and inseparable friends, Athos, Porthos, and Aramis in French, musketeers of King Louis XIII, who live by the motto, tous pour un, un pour tous, all for one, one for all. Together, all four men, that's why there are four of them, pit their wits against the Machiavellic first minister of the king, le Cardinal de Richelieu, as well as against the beautiful and treacherous Lady de Winter. They save the honor of the queen, Anne d'Autriche, and in one of the last scenes of the novel, after a mock trial, they assist in the beheading of Milady de Winter. And in fact, this is enacted on the stage. Well, of course, the actress is not really being beheaded, but you can imagine that she is. D'Artagnan is the typical romantic hero who is driven by love and chivalry. He is brave, noble, ambitious, and intelligent. In this novel, Dumas exploits the well-known feelings of mistrust and the battles for influence that existed between the historical Louis XIII of France and le Cardinal de Richelieu, as well the hostility that existed between the Queen and the Cardinal. Yet, although the story is steeped in historical facts, Dumas took a lot of artistic license with his depiction of characters and events. The novel was so successful that Dumas adapted it to the theatre, had it presented on the stage in 1845. And he continued with the saga of D'Artagnan and the Three Musketeers in two other novels, 20 ans après, 20 years later, Vicomte de Bragelonne, the Viscount of Bragelonne. Again, I'll go briefly on the plot, so you see, because I'll be talking about the Man in the Iron Mask, too, in a minute. 20 ans après, 20 years later, was first serialized from January to August 1845. It tells the story of the musketeers 20 years after they have triumphed over Milady de Winter. In this one, civil war is raging in France and England, which endangers the throne of France and young Louis XIV. While in England, Cromwell is threatening to send Charles I to the scaffold. The musketeers come out of retirement to redress wrongs and come face to face with the forces of history and the evil son of Milady de Winter. The musketeers are valiant and just in their efforts to bring the young, to protect the young Louis XIV and the doomed Charles I from their attackers. The next one, Le Vicomte de Bragelonne, the Viscount of Bragelonne, is the last novel forming the trilogy of the musketeers. And they all die in this one. Well, not all of them, except one. And also the most nostalgic and pessimistic of all three. It appeared first in serial form between 1847, 1850, in the Journal Le Siècle, in the Journal Le Siècle. It depicts the court of the young Louis XIV, offers a fictitious and romantic explanation for the historical L'Homme au Masque de Fer, the Man in the Iron Mask. Even though this episode only occupies a very small portion of the novel, here the musketeers are much older. The youngest one, D'Artagnan, is 50. Porthos has become a baron. Aramis has become the archbishop, as well as general of the Jesuits. And the person who gives his name to the title of the novel, Raoul de Bragelonne, is the natural son of Athos. But he dies in a battle early on in the novel. As a result of his sudden death, his father, Athos, dies of grief. Later on, Porthos dies in a rebellion against the king, and D'Artagnan dies at Maastricht, as he is about to be made Maréchal de France, Marshal of France. Only Aramis learns to adapt to the world of intrigues that surrounds him. This novel describes the decline of nobility by the sword, as exemplified by the musketeers. It recounts the birth of a new kind of nobility at the court of young Louis XIV. From now on, it is only through intrigues and flattery, and not armed exploits, that one can gain prominence at court. I'll talk about the third one, La Reine Margot, and I have two slides here, the next slide. Have you ever seen the film, Queen Margot, anyone? Yes? La Reine Margot is a novel of suspense and drama. It was written in 1845, serialized in La Presse between 1844 and April 1845. The story is set in Renaissance Paris between 1572-1575, during the bloody French Wars known as the War of Religion, between Catholics and Protestants. Margot is the beautiful and proud daughter of Henri II and his scheming Catholic wife, Catherine de Médicis. She's always scheming in Dumas' novels. Catherine arranges a marriage between Margot and Henri de Navarre, who's a Huguenot. Just 6 days after the wedding, French Catholics slaughter over 30,000 Huguenots on St. Bartholomew's Day, a scheme brought about by Catherine. Margot, who does not love Henri, saves him, although she also begins a passionate affair with La Mole, a Protestant. Violent court intrigues, judicial torture, murders by poisoning follow and threaten the lives of everybody. La Reine Margot has contributed, or the novel La Reine Margot has contributed to the evil and Machiavellic reputation of Catherine de Médicis and to the supposed licentiousness and promiscuity of Queen Margot. Dumas' most successful novels are not, some people think they're not very deep, some critics believe that, I'm not sure, but they contain marvelous adventures and actions and bigger than life characters. He wrote mainly historical novels where he took a great liberty with the truth in order to achieve a good story, but never claimed they were historically accurate. He also wrote many other novels between 1838 and 52. He serialized most of them in daily journals, held readers captive with each episode ending with the words à suivre, which means to be continued. He also made a fortune with this impressive literary production. In 1844, he had the Château de Monte Cristo built at near Saint-Germain-en-Laye. I have a slide of his chateau that, it's the next one. Yeah. So he had this building built, and he called it the Château de Monte Cristo. He also built a separate house on the same property, and there's also another slide that shows the back of this chateau. It's a grand chateau, as you can see. It still exists. If you go to France one day, you should go and visit it. He also built on the same property another house, which he named the Château d'If, where he would spend up to 14 hours each day writing his novels. He led a lavish lifestyle there, gave great parties, received a considerable number of guests, who took advantage of his generosity. He also traveled a great deal. His activities swallowed a considerable amount of the wealth that he had earned and accumulated through his writing, and they often left him in financial troubles. In spite of all his impressive production, many of Dumas' contemporaries treated his work with contempt and derision and questioned the authorship of some of his novels and his astounding literary fecundity. In 1845, for example, a journalist by the name Charles Jean-Baptiste Jacquot claimed that Dumas was an opportunist, a thief, and a plagiarist. He accused Dumas of directing a fiction factory in which he employed lesser-known writers whose job it was to churn out episodes of serials that Dumas would then reassemble, rearrange, copy in his own handwriting, sign, and present the final product as his own. As most of his attacks were focused on Dumas' private life, Dumas sued him for defamation of character, and Jacquot received a 6-month prison sentence and was forced to pay a fine. On the 20th of February, 1847, La Reine Margot was turned into a play with the collaboration of Auguste Maquet, was based on the novel, and it was presented on the Paris stage. Sometime later, they also had two more adaptations of Les Trois Mousquetaires and Monte Cristo, The Count of Monte Cristo, but these plays did not fare very well at all. They never really caught on. When King Louis-Philippe was ousted, he was ousted too during a revolution, Dumas was not looked upon favorably by the newly elected president, Louis-Napoléon Bonaparte. And it brought for Dumas a whole series of disappointments. It also signaled the decline of his huge fortune. His writing had earned him a great deal of money, but he was frequently insolvent as a result of spending lavishly on women and sumptuous living. The large Château de Monte Cristo that he was often built was filled with strangers and acquaintances who took advantage of him. He collaborated briefly in a daily newspaper, founded a political journal, which did not fare very well. He was sued by many creditors. He traveled to Russia, where French was the second language, and where his writings were enormously popular. He spent 2 years in Russia, but he came back to France to seek adventure and fodder for more stories, but he was not very successful. He suffered a stroke on September, he lost all his fortune and was completely broke. He suffered a stroke on September 1870. The last and very sad years of his life were made easier by the devotion of one of his daughters, as well as the attention of his son, the famous Alexandre Dumas-Fils, who in the end took care of all his financial needs. He died in the town of Puy, near Dieppe, on December the 5th, 1870, and is buried, and was buried, in the cemetery of Villers-Cotterêts. But in 2002, that's about 8 years ago, under orders of the French President Jacques Chirac, Dumas' body was exhumed, and in a lavish, televised ceremony, his new coffin, draped in a blue velvet cloth, flanked by four Republican guards, addressed as the Musketeers, Athos, Porthos, Aramis, and D'Artagnan, was transported in a solemn procession to the Panthéon de Paris, the great mausoleum where French luminaries are interred. And this honor is accorded only to national heroes. In an interview following the ceremony, President Chirac said that he thought that Dumas should have been interred at the Panthéon long ago, and if he hadn't been, it was because racism had existed then. And he said that a wrong had now been righted with Alexandre Dumas, who is now enshrined alongside fellow authors Victor Hugo, etc. Last year, I'll finish in just a minute, a long-standing scholarly debate was vigorously reopened when a new movie about Dumas and his ghostwriter Auguste Maquet came out. It was the title was L'autre Dumas, The Other Dumas. It starred Gérard Depardieu as Dumas, and at issue is whether Dumas was the brains and talent behind the 17 novels that him and Maquet co-wrote, or if Maquet was the unsung genius whom Dumas treated as a slave. The film favors the storyline of Maquet as victim and Dumas as the ogre. However, les Dumasiens, that means those who like Dumas, that means they are the Dumas loyalists, still regard Maquet as little more than a secondary writer, secretary, who provided the great master Dumas with some elements of plot and structure. But Maquet has his defenders also. There's a writer by the name of Bernard Filaire, in fact I saw his interview on TV, who wrote a book describing Dumas as a kind of highway robber, too busy as a bon vivant to actually take the time to write his novels. The truth, according to France's foremost Dumas scholar, Claude Schopp, is not nearly as dramatic as the movie and legend would have it. Schopp believes that they had an unusual alchemy together. They both understood the magic of it and both profited from it in their own way. Maquet was a talented but struggling writer who couldn't get published under his own name, and so he collaborated with the already well-known Dumas, Schopp believes. The partnership worked well, and Maquet often provided plots, structure, historical context, and Dumas built on the existing story with his unique flair. In exchange for being well paid, Maquet agreed to give up all rights to the work he did with Dumas and public recognition, not because he was a dupe, but because he understood the marketplace. Yeah, the two did later fall out over over money, and Maquet did take Dumas to court several times over money and recognition issues, but they were both smart in their own ways, said Schopp. Nobody was the real victim here. And to this day, this debate rages on. Thank you very much, and that's the end of my presentation. Merci beaucoup. Questions?
Somebody beat me to the punch, or?
Are there questions? I can't read it. There are three more slides? It's okay. When he was interred, when his body was being taken to the Panthéon, they were all dressed as musketeers. I forgot to show this slide. Yeah. And this is just the recent bibliography that has been is being produced on Dumas. Since he was interred in 2002, there is a new interest in his work. In fact, I'm doing a lot of work on his novels at the moment. But he wrote so many novels, it will take me a lifetime to read all of them, probably. But I'm starting with those that he wrote at the same time that he collaborated with Mackie. Yeah.
It seems kind of odd to me that, I had the impression that maybe he didn't get the kind of burial he deserved because of his mixed ancestry. Is that true, or?
No. You see, for him, his mixed ancestry never worked against him. In fact, he thought it worked in his favor. He was never even concerned about it. And most people in those days didn't care. But I think it's nowadays, I'm not sure why Chirac said it. But there had been, for about 20 years, there had been this push by the Dumasiens to have him interred at the Panthéon. And they brought all sorts of reasons why he hadn't been. They said, oh, probably it was racism. But Dumas himself would have totally denied that, I think.
Well, plus he had the circle of friends he was in,
yes.
And his own son was in the
Academy.
French Academy.
Yes, so he would have probably laughed at this. As I said, I don't know. I'm just starting research on him.
I mean, speaking of your research, I mean, I guess the obvious question is whether your methodology of trying to determine authorship through analysis has been brought to bear on the question of Dumas' authorship.
Well, I know that I saw recently that there's a new book that came out about maybe 2 years ago where a writer actually looked at the style, but they didn't use my kind of linguistic fingerprinting, statistics, etc. I'm not sure what she looked at. So for me, I'll be looking at more than one novel, certainly. Maybe five that were written by Mackie, five by him within a very specific time period. But it's a huge undertaking. I realize this will take me years, maybe 2 or 3 years to do, because I have to scan books, do all sorts of stuff. But if I have time, that's what I'd like to devote, you know, myself to doing. But I'm sorry, does that answer your question? Yeah?
We have a question off in Illuminate, and I'm going to give Karen the mic and she'll ask it. Just going to read your question,
yeah.
Karen. It says, just wondering about the recent surge of research and writing. What is or are the main themes of or interests of these researchers? Or is there any discernible direction? Where do you see yours fitting in?
Karen, yes, I did list. I do have a list of books that were recently written. I must admit I haven't read them. It's just that I was interested in knowing whether he is attracting more critics now than before 2002. So I came across these. I've read one or two, or just I've done some very cursory reading, so I cannot answer your question, I'm afraid. Do we have any more?
Well, there's a question in the room.
I can figure out how to work this. I've got two questions, yeah. Nina. The first is where you stand on the debate between the relationship between him and his ghostwriter. And the second, I'm quite fascinated that Chirac would exhume this guy's body and make a huge production. I mean, it sounded very theatrical. But was he just a big fan of the author, or was there political motivation?
Well, I'll tell you, Dumas is read by almost everybody. Every child reads Dumas. I mean, he's well known. They may not be reading Balzac, but I think every child knows about the Three Musketeers. He's so popular. But he is regarded as a second-rate writer. He is, compared to the other giants of the 19th century. Certainly he's not. He's a historical, he's not. Let me rephrase that. He was more interested in plots. And there are lots of denouement, which means sudden, you know, changes, which are not very realistic. It's more for a good story. when you compare that to the writings of Flaubert, who's much more thought out, laid out, structure-wise, he spent maybe a month to write a paragraph or a page, whereas Dumas would write without even thinking. As, you know, the way he was speaking, he would just write. So he was not considered to be a great writer as such, or at least in terms of the plot development of the characters, etc. But he was well known. Everyone loved him. So I think because of that, because of this love for Dumas, he decided it was time. And of course, there are people who do a lot of research on Dumas who've always said he has to be rehabilitated, he has to be put in the same league as the other writers. And it seems to me that recently there is a direction in that, you know, they seem to be going in that direction. I could be wrong, but suddenly everyone seems to be writing on his life or his books or whatever. Does that answer your question? And the second question?
The second one was where you stand on the debate between women and ghostwriter.
Well, I would like to believe that Dumas wrote this himself. But I won't know this for sure until I really, as I say, do a study on their style. But even then, I will say, within this level of probability, it looks likely that Dumas wrote it or Maquet wrote it. But I haven't read anything written by Maquet. I had never heard of him. This attracted my attention when this film came out last year. That's when the whole thing started in my mind. I mean, I had read Dumas as a child, but then I read the very, you know, sanitized version, 200 pages, whereas all his novels are about, 1,600 pages?
Monte Cristo, 1,600, two volumes, 1,600
pages. But I read the 200-page version. So, I read him in French, of course, as a young girl.
Well, Avina, of course, this is a special case for this kind of authorship analysis,
yes,
because it's not a case of alleged plagiarism.
No.
It's a case of acknowledged co-authorship and then a big fight over, the degree of... So, I guess the question is whether your analysis is finely grained enough that in that sort of situation...
I don't know. You're right.
I
have to look at lots of variables before I even, you know, get involved in this. Because it is an acknowledged fact that they did collaborate. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
We do know that Maquet did provide him with plots and ideas, but he claims, and a lot of people claim, that the writing is his. I'm looking at the writing, not the themes. Not the ideas, but the handwriting. Is it his style?
Yeah.
Did he write it?
And that's clearly separable from plot.
From plot. I'm not looking at plot.
Yeah.
I'm not looking at plot. I'm not looking at themes or anything like that. I'm looking more at the style itself. And if I believe that there is a unique fingerprint, will it... It could be something that is beyond... Not beyond me, because one person alone cannot do it. Could very well be that, because his novels are so huge. I did that with Gary, but then his novels were more, you know, about 200, 300 pages. I could do it. But these are 1,000 pages. 1,600 for one novel. So it's a lot to read or to work with.
It seems to me there's maybe an analogy in the copyright cases, in the law concerning music, for example. Where, you're allowed to copy certain things, but, once it reaches a certain level or a certain kind of elaboration, then there's a clear line, or at least the courts think they've drawn a clear line.
Mm. But in that case, I think if what the film at least, L'Autre Dumas is showing, of course it's a film version, it doesn't mean it's true, that Maquet was well paid for the service that he rendered. But he was the brains. He's the one who wrote all this, not Dumas. Dumas, just because of his name, he just profited from it. Yeah. But anyway, it's an interesting topic. It's something that could keep me going for 5 years, I guess. I don't know.
I just want to get to a couple of comments. Just more comments, it looks like, made by Mark McCutcheon. He writes, pop culture adaptation aside, Mattel has appropriated the Three Musketeers story for a new proliferation of Barbie dolls, DVDs, and related products. Safe to say that the Barbie version goes beyond sanitizing the original, even while gender-bending
it.
And too bad for the Dumas estate can't sue Mattel.
Sue Mattel, yeah. Well, you see, they're part of pop culture. I know the Musketeers and everything that Dumas has written is part of pop culture, has always been. That's just part of his legacy. And that's why he was not taken very seriously for the longest time. Because if you're a great artist, it's not for just anybody, is it? Your writing is just for a few elite intellectuals or something. Whereas everyone could read him. Any more questions? I think someone else had a question. Is it Mark?
Did Dickens have this problem? I mean, Dickens was comparably popular, wasn't he? Or was he?
Well, Dickens did write in that format, serialized.
Yeah
he too would write, and then each week or each, I'm not sure if it's each, maybe Joe knows this? No? Each week or each 2 weeks he would, add. I mean, there's somebody who did this here, Bob Babiak. He would serialize some of his stories. Was it the Gano Block or something? Yeah, so I don't know if he wrote every week or whatever. I didn't read it. I know he did this, but Dumas was just Babiak. He did this all the time, and people would wait eagerly for the next installment. You know, they would be lining up to buy the newspaper so they'd get continuation of the story. It was that captivating for them, because you see they didn't have soap operas, they didn't have TV. So reading was a great, I suppose, pastime for them. That's it?
Mark has another comment.
Oh.
He's noting that similar questions are now being asked of the collaborative relationship between Jane Austen and her editor, as well as between Mary and Percy Shelley on her work.
Oh, thank you, Mark. I didn't know that. Yeah.
You'd be busy for the next 10 years.
Trying to figure this one out.
So, Vina, you're just looking at the style, the writing style.
Yeah.
Now, that's interesting, because maybe this is a larger question for you literature people. I don't know, it seems to me it's the ideas that are the most important, but then methodologically, how would you do that?
Well,
because especially you've got somebody who's writing serially, that's a lot of ideas to come up every week or whatever it is to keep coming up with these new and exciting ideas. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to me it's kind of immaterial whether his collaborator was paid for it or not.
Yeah.
I mean, the interesting question is, who's the genius behind it?
Yeah, you're right. But the thing is, if you believe, I've used this methodology, that's why I'm interested in it. You know, I use style, or what I call linguistic fingerprinting, to decide whether this could have been written. It's done, many times for the Shakespeare controversy. Who wrote it? And, this debate has been going on for a long, long time. I didn't invent it. It's just been around for a long time. So I was thinking, if I apply the same methodology, but I'm looking at style here, and if you believe that style is unique, but it's regardless of theme, regardless of character, it's how do you define style, and that is very important. There are different ways of defining it, and I have my way. I don't want to go into that now, because I gave a talk about that, I don't know, 4 years ago or something here. So it is there. It's been recorded if you want. You can see what my methodology is. If you believe in it, and I do, so then you can apply this for that situation. But then again, as I've said, his novels are so huge that it may take me many, many years, or maybe I can't even handle it unless I gather a group of people around me. It's the kind of stuff that shirk, you know? No, it's true. It's true. To get a shirk. Money to do this as a group of people together. One person can't handle this alone, I think. or grad students to help you with this, I think, anyway.
Another comment coming in from Illuminate, Karen Wall points out that also in pop culture, several of the novels have been Hollywoodized in recent years. Interesting to think about what it is at present that makes such plots, films, and Barbie dolls compelling again.
Is she asking me a question or making a statement?
Well, I think the question is, you know, what is it about these themes, I guess, that make them appear time and time again? As Mark points out, it's freedom to exploit, like Disney does, public domain works.
To me, this is Joe, to me the films, I mean, what's interesting is the fact that he's great. He has great characters, great villains, you know, and you can get actors and directors that can produce, you know, they can take advantage of all these wonderful, interesting characters. There's nothing flat about this. So the women are always beautiful and dangerous. And then, you know, the swashbuckling, it's always that sort of, and I think we still have interest in that kind of, whether we're adults or children, we still have interest in that kind of suspense, intrigue, adventure.
The kind of stuff, the good films. You know,
all the time pretending that we're actually studying history.
It's social networking.
Yes. I think he tells a good story.
Yes.
That's the good. That's the thing about Dumas. He knows how to tell a good story.
Very interesting character.
Yes. But is he a great writer in terms of plot, in terms of structure, in terms of character, in terms of depth of character? I have not gone there yet. But that's, you know, something I will explore if I take on this project. But that's something that we can look at. For example, if we look at Flaubert's character, Madame Bovary, we realize this one is psychologically well described. We can understand what's going on here. But Dumas has no character like that. He's a more, I won't say cardboard, but they're more, what is the word I'm looking for? Stereotypes? Yeah. Yeah, two-dimensional. Or perhaps I'm wrong.
Which is fine for film.
Which is fine for film, which is fine for young adolescents, although young adolescents wouldn't be reading what I read, you know, the whole version of the novel is not meant for adolescents, torture and orgies and stuff. It wouldn't be.
No. For today's adults. Come on!
They probably know much more than we do.
Twilight.
Yeah. For youngsters nowadays, it wouldn't shock them, no. Any more questions?
Some of the comments are about why now, I guess. This is what Mark is asking online.
Why?
And same with Karen. She's stuck on the connection between, again, this classic literature and the recycling of myths over time. But is there something about today that makes this more frequent, or is it happening more frequently, or is this just an observation that needs to be borne out empirically?
Well, in dangerous times, we like to have heroes, right?
Yes. I was going to say, perhaps we need heroes.
Yeah. Perhaps we have no more good ideas.
Yeah, perhaps we're looking for... we need heroes. I think that's what it is. In difficult times, we want to have heroes around us.
Karen or Mark makes a point about public domain access. I mean, is it the case that information is more freely available, that these ideas can be recycled more easily?
Are you asking me this question?
I guess the room and everybody online.
I don't know. Maybe Mark knows. Yeah.
Royalties.
Yeah, you don't have to pay royalties to these authors anymore, so that might be part of it.
Mm. Oh, you're talking about the Barbie version of the Musketeers and stuff like that? Yes. Yeah.
The two Marks are coming up with the same idea. What does that tell you about?
They're right on the mark.
It's too bad. I cannot. That's why I'm saying it. Okay.
Oh, yeah, would
Would the royalties for Dumas have expired like 50 years after his death, or
would it be
50?
Would
it be the same? Is that by international agreement?
I guess so. I don't know. I'm only guessing here.
Yeah.
But I'm sure Dumas must have some, some grandchildren somewhere, perhaps, who lay claim to some of this. I don't know. His estate.
Mark is saying, broadly speaking, anything before about 1920s is public domain. So there you go.
There you go. Yeah. So he has no, there are no rights on any of his work. That's what he's saying, right? Yeah. Okay. All right. Questions? Any more? Finished. Bon, merci. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone online, and special thanks to Andrew and Alice, who hung in despite their rooms being less than full. For those online, if you didn't know, we tried video conferencing, and it seemed to work well for us in the room here, but our colleagues in Calgary and Athabasca, perhaps they need goodies to entice them out to those rooms, so maybe, Alice, we need to get fruits and treats to those locations as well, but we'll have to do that in the new year, because I don't think we're going to have a talk in December, but we will try this again with the video conferencing in January. So thank you, everyone, and this is goodbye from Edmonton.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, we're still talking. Oh, yeah. Still, because we're here.